I am Brianna Skella. I am interviewing Lydia Wolfram. Would you like to introduce yourself, Lydia?
Hi, I'm Lydia Wolfram, and I do research at WSU.
Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah, so when I started last year, we were mostly looking at heat shock proteins in cancer cells, because that can be a strong indicator of cancer. I can't talk on computer. Of the presence of cancer in patients. So, but now this year I have my own research project, and I'm looking at 6 different cancer lines and their comparative amount of heat shock proteins that they produce, as to try to figure out different treatments for cancer patients.
Ooh, so what would one experiment for this look like, and how long would that take?
So my general protocol is I grow up some cells in an incubator, and then I heat shock them. So I put them in basically 37 to 42 degrees Celsius water, and then I basically kill them. And then I put them into what's called a Western blot, and I see how much protein they've produced.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't like speaking on camera, and I forgot about that.
No one. So could you maybe run me through some of your protocol for your experiments?
So as long as the cells are alive, the first thing that I do is count them, which I use a hemocytometer for that. So the process is a little bit lengthy to describe, but I get the flask that they've been in. And so you put them in an incubator, which is at 37 degrees Celsius, and that's just to make them happy, I guess. That's what we always say in our lab. But you want them to have the best environment possible for them to grow. And you put them in media, which is just all the vitamins and nutrients that they would need to grow and divide. So what I do is I take the cells out of the incubator, and then I add trypsin, which basically breaks the focal adhesions to the bottom of the flask, which is what they're attached to, and that means they're free floating in the liquid media that we've put them in. And then I take the media out of the flask, and I put it into a, what's the word? Like a test tube. And then I can spin them down at 3,000 RPM for 3 minutes, and that basically makes a little pellet of live cells at the bottom of the test tube. And then I can add some chemicals that will dye them, and so then I can see them under the microscope. And then I add them to the hemocytometer, and then I count them under the microscope. And then I do some like math and stuff to figure out how many cells per milliliter I have. And then depending on that, I can either like split the cells into 2 flasks or them, but I have to have at least what's called 70% confluency, which confluency is like how much of the bottom of the flask they're covering. So I have to have 70%, which is kind of a lot. So oftentimes I have to split the cells.
How do you measure that?
Oh, okay. Sorry. I kind of skipped over that. So you put the chemicals that kind of, well, they don't dye them, but you basically take just 10 microliters of the cell solution that I made with that pellet, and then I put it into, okay, sorry, I'm kind of all over the place. So then I put it into a hemocytometer, and a hemocytometer is what people used to use to look at blood, because hemo, right? But we use it to count cells, and it's like it's a 9x9 grid, and then
so can you tell me a little bit about your research with CRISPR-Cas9?
Okay, so CRISPR stands for clusters of regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, and it was basically a defense mechanism, a genomic defense mechanism for bacteria, and it was discovered in the 1980s. Basically, what bacteria would do is, if it was attacked by a virus, it would take parts of that virus's DNA as a memory, so the next time it was attacked by that same virus, it would recognize it and be able to protect itself from that virus. So basically, CRISPR-Cas9 is used for genetic editing, deletions, or additions. And although, and it's being used in labs, and it's a really new, exciting field, because it's so specific, you can give the enzyme a very specific section of someone's DNA, and the enzyme can go in and cut it out and either replace it with something else, add something to it, or delete it completely and let the cell fix its own DNA. So if you have too much genetic material, for example, this enzyme and this procedure can delete that extra genetic material that you don't need. If you have too little, you can add to it. If something's wrong and you need a different base pair, for example, you can delete it, or you can change it.
Are there any ethical concerns that arise from this type of research?
Yeah, absolutely. So, because it's genetic editing, there's some of the It's genetic editing. There's a lot of concerns. Mostly what biomedical ethics professors, I guess, and scholars are worried about is what's called, not so much about somatic cells, which are non-sex cells, because that only affects one generation of a person. But if you want to edit, say, like your sperm or your eggs, so future generations change, that can have long-lasting consequences on what humanity looks like in 50 years. So it hasn't been done yet. I mean, we haven't genetically edited gametes, which are sex cells, because people really haven't come to a consensus yet on the biomedical ethics of this. But it's generally agreed upon that somatic cells or non-sex cells are less ethically concerning to edit, because that's just affecting one person. Whereas if you edit your eggs or your sperm, you're affecting essentially several generations down the line, and it would take hundreds of years to correct those changes that you're making in a couple days. For example, right now in labs, technicians are working to find out how this might affect common genetic diseases such as Hutchinson's disease, which is a horrible genetic deformity that causes a patient a lot of pain and would be great if we could solve it. But it hasn't been tried on humans because A, the ethical concerns of it haven't really reached a conclusion yet, and B, we don't know exactly what would happen to a fully grown human if we gave them this treatment. In the future, though, I mean, if this technology goes further, you could potentially, for lack of a better word, eradicate things like Down syndrome, which raises more ethical concerns. I mean, it's like wiping out part of the population, which isn't necessarily like a bad part of the population. I understand more wiping out genetic diseases because those are harmful to many generations of people and can be really painful and cause early death and huge medical costs for the families. But things that don't harm patients are much more questionable if we were to use this technology on people, like people with Down syndrome or non-life-threatening genetic differences.
I also understand this research is applicable to crops and agriculture. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So farmers, immediately when they heard about this technology, and agricultural scientists saw a potential for genetically modified crops, because as the world needs more and more food, you have to select for the crops that won't die as easily, will produce more food, et cetera, et cetera. So this technology was immediately jumped upon by agricultural scientists and the agricultural community to use on their popular crops, because you can create more, not more sustainable, but longer lasting, more yield producing crops for like different types of crops. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, Lydia, I want to thank you for the research that you take part in here at WSU, and I also want to thank you for sitting down with me.